The seat of science, earth, and earth's proud mistress, Rome, where now are all their glories, we scarce can find their tomb. Then guard your rights, Americans, nor stoop to lawless sway. Oppose, oppose, oppose it for North America. Proud Albion bowed to Caesar and numerous lords before, to Picts, to Danes, to Normans, and many masters more. But we can boast Americans have never fallen a prey. Huzzah, 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 huzzah for free America.
A summer-long political debate might seem an unlikely source of drama. But in 1787, for the delegates to the Constitutional Convention, the stakes could not have been higher. As my guest Carol Burkin has written, a sense of crisis led the Founding Fathers to Philadelphia, where they gathered behind locked doors and bolted windows to overthrow the legitimate government of the United States. By writing the Constitution, they staged what she calls a bloodless coup d'etat. Carol Burkin is a professor of history at Baruch College and the City University of New York, and the author of A Brilliant Solution, Inventing the American Constitution. Professor Burkin, welcome.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Your book about the Constitution is entitled A Brilliant Solution. What were the problems that needed to be solved in 1787?
They're multiple. I think one way to look at this is that the Articles of Confederation were a wonderful fulfillment of some of the principles of revolution. The problem is what one needs to do when you're running a nation sometimes turns out to be very different from what you're doing when you protest and make a revolution. The Articles fulfilled the idea that you avoided tyranny and you avoided abuse of power by making sure that the government was terribly restrained and constrained, that it lacked certain powers. And I think more than anything, the Articles of Confederation were designed by states that saw their own local assemblies as the source of sovereignty and power. No taxation without representation really was a reference to their own local colonial governments. And so they design a constitution the first time around that fits these principles. Then they wake up the morning after and they discover that this doesn't work when you're involved in diplomacy, trade, finance, and politics as an independent nation. And so the problems that they faced were how, I think, to make a transition to a government that would make a viable nation in the world of nations instead of a government that symbolized the values of the revolution. Very specifically, the country was in deep, terrible debt, and the central government had no power to tax. The states each set their own commerce rules and were setting tariffs against one another that pretty seriously hindered interstate trade, brought it to a standstill. Different money for each state. It was like trying to travel through Europe in the old days before the euro, where you had to change money at every border. And I think, seriously, the men who went to the convention in Philadelphia believed the country was on the verge of collapse. I don't think that's an exaggeration. If you read their letters, if you read what they have to say to one another, they genuinely believed that the nation was about to vanish.
You call what they do a coup d'etat, which suggests that someone or something is being overthrown. How'd they get away with that?
Well, that was a bit of literary drama. It is a coup d'etat in the sense that they were only in power to recommend amendments to the Articles of Confederation. The Confederation Congress allowed them to meet, and the assumption was they would send recommendations for how to strengthen the government. One of the first things they do, in essence, is say, we're throwing out that constitution, we're writing a new one. That is, in effect, a coup d'etat. But they got away with it because when they were done, unlike in the history of many other countries, they didn't enforce the constitution by raising an army and marching on the Confederation Congress. They didn't do it by fiat. They didn't do it by force. They submitted it to ratifying conventions in every state. And in that sense, they were true to the constitutionalism and to the republican principles that they had fought for in the American Revolution.
Americans are sometimes thought of as an optimistic, hopeful people. But the writers of the Constitution certainly weren't. It comes across very strongly in your book. These guys think humans are corruptible, evil. They didn't trust the people generally. They didn't even trust each other.
That's absolutely true. One of the ironies is that they're so obsessed with power and the way in which power corrupts everyone and the way in which there are so many avenues for corruption, bribery, threats, cabals. And who are they really talking about? They're talking about one another, oddly, because they are going to be the men who lead both the state governments and the national government. And Cecilia Kenyon once wrote a wonderful article called Men of Little Faith, and she was talking about the people who oppose the Constitution. But with all due respect, if you read Madison's notes, you can't get away from the fact that the founders were also men of little faith, and that what they're trying to do is give power and then restrain it at every step of the way. They're faced with a terrible problem that they want to create a powerful, effective government, but they want to create hundreds of safeguards that protects them from the abuse of that power. And that's really the underlying theme of the convention. How do we give power, and then how do we control it?
One of the places where they focus their concern is on whether or not they should have a single executive, a president. Edmund Randolph of Virginia calls a single executive, these are his words, the fetus of monarchy.
Right.
And yes. You summarize other delegates who have basically the same view. An executive can do serious damage to the nation. An ambitious president can undermine the will of Congress, et cetera, et cetera. Given such concerns, how do we end up with a president at all?
Well, it's interesting. They did want to separate the executive branch from the legislative branch. They thought that this would be more efficient. They had certainly learned from the Confederation government that without an executive branch, things did not get done. So they wanted to do that, but they didn't know how they wanted that branch constituted. Some people said it should be three men, one from New England, one from the middle states, and one from the South. Some said it should be a committee from the legislature that rotated, membership rotated. They were extremely concerned about a single person. What weakened that concern was that everyone in the room looked directly at George Washington and said, this will be the person who is the president. And so that eased some fears. What really turns the tide, ironically, they start talking about the presidency first and they realize they can't make any decisions till they solve their real issue, which is the nature of the legislature. And when they resolve that, they come back to the presidency. And what they have compromised is that the Senate will represent the states. That is, Madison, Hamilton, the real nationalists wanted a legislature that was based entirely on proportional representation, because this would diminish the power of the states. This would not give them a branch of government that belonged to them. When they lose that fight, they now want to make the executive a branch of government that symbolically represents the whole nation, not the states. And so they hit upon the idea of a single individual whose office is symbolic, more than powerful, but symbolic of national unity. And this is why men like Madison begin to push for some form of popular election of the president. I don't think he would have pushed for this before he lost the battle to make the Senate representational instead of a body that represented the states.
You've mentioned Madison's desire to have the president elected directly. It's a reminder that while most of the parts of the original Constitution obviously continue, some have been changed. We no longer elect U.S. senators the way the men of 1787 wanted them elected, by state legislatures. And yet the Electoral College remains as the way we elect a president. How did that come to exist in the first place?
You know, I've been asked this on CNN and by talk show radio hosts during the during the Gore-Bush disputed election. And it's really so interesting. I think the overwhelming number of people in America believe, as one CNN fellow asked me, did they create the Electoral College to make sure the president would visit Wyoming? I was just overwhelmed by, I'm rarely speechless, and I couldn't come up with an answer to that. The Electoral College really arises out of the realities of the 18th century. when transportation and communication were really very different from today. And the assumption was, and it was accurate, that if you had a popular election, people in Georgia would vote for someone they knew, and people in Virginia would vote for someone they knew. Strange as it may seem to most people, Thomas Jefferson was not a household word in New Hampshire. People in Georgia had never heard of John Adams. There were only two people everybody had ever heard of, and that was Benjamin Franklin and George Washington. So the assumption was that you would have 600 candidates for the presidency. No one was going to get on a horse and ride from Maine to Georgia to campaign. And so the kinds of possibilities we have today didn't exist. And the Electoral College is designed with this assumption that the state legislatures would pick men to be in the Electoral College who had served in government and so consequently knew people from other states. And then they could say, oh, well, I know John Adams. He's a terrific fellow, and I'll cast my vote for him. This was a practical solution to the fact that people didn't know one another if they came from different states. Today, it does not serve that purpose, obviously. Today, when you can have a national debate between the two candidates that can be seen by everyone in America, and today when you can give a talk in New York and then fly to California and give a talk, today, really, the Electoral College is outmoded in terms of its original intent. Now, whether it ought to still exist is a very controversial question. I come down, though as a historian, my view is no more valuable about current events than anyone else's, but I come down on the side of amending the Electoral College and going directly to a popular vote, because the conditions are so totally different than they were in 1787.
There are all sorts of issues that engaged the delegates in 1787, whether large or small states should get certain kinds of representation, whether a president should be one or three people. One issue that interestingly didn't seem to engage them all that much was the moral question of slavery. And I wonder, how did they avoid talking about that or being riven apart by it?
If you read the tone of the convention, I say in A Brilliant Solution, the impression that comes across very clearly is that this is not a scene in which you're going to get great oratory, in which you're going to debate philosophical questions, in which you're going to raise moral questions. This is more a kind of roll-up-your-sleeves working committee activity. They really think that the nation is in crisis, and they really think that the issue at hand is whether you can create a strong enough central government to pay its taxes, to deal with foreign countries, to protect its borders. And so they stick really closely to those, what they would consider to be prime issues. They don't even raise a lot of issues that open up, one might say, a can of social worms. And I think that these were issues that would be divisive, that would take an enormous amount of discussion. They're very practical at the convention. We can condemn them for this. I mean, we can say they ought to have discussed this. But I think that had they spent a lot of time on this, we would probably all be speaking French or have the British flag still flying over the country, or we would be in the midst of a perpetual conflict between different regions of what was once the United States. That's what they felt. They were fighting to save the country. And when they do raise the issue of slavery, when Gouverneur Morris and George Mason want to raise it and have it discussed, the delegates say, not now, not now, that's not what we're here for. And so I think that they avoided it because they thought they had something else on their plate that they had to handle.
The Constitution, as we've talked about, was written behind closed doors and windows. How was it received when it finally saw the light of day and the rest of the country found out what the delegates had been doing?
One of the most interesting things is that these men did keep it secret. Here are a group of guys who love to talk, and they swear that they're not going to talk about it in public, and they hold to it. And this is really quite remarkable. James Madison, for instance, you can just tell in his letters to his father and his letters to Thomas Jefferson that he is bursting at the seams. He wants to blab what's happening, and he doesn't. But people are discussing what they think the Constitutional Convention is doing. No one is really very surprised, I don't think, when they come up with a document that says the central government will have the power to tax. So I think the general outlines of the solutions that they're coming up with would probably be not much of a surprise to politically astute or politically active people. But when they do come out with the Constitution, there is an immediate opposition that develops. The anti-federalists develop rather quickly in opposing the creation of a much stronger central government. So it's safe to say that if people were not surprised, they were very quickly polarized over whether to adopt this constitution or not. Patrick Henry, you know, has the wonderful statement. He says, "I smell a rat," which suggests that everyone understood that what this convention was going to do was create a much stronger central government.
Well, Professor Birkin, thanks so much for visiting with us.
I enjoyed it. Thank you for inviting me.
I've been speaking with Carol Birkin, the author of A Brilliant Solution, Inventing the American Constitution.